Okay.
Hello.
Good morning. We're gonna try and do a Blogging Heads redo here. Lou and I did one the other day that was lost to the dustbin of history. But I am Michael Goldfarb, online editor of the Weekly Standard, and
my name is Malou Innocent, foreign policy analyst at the Cato Institute, live from Seoul, South Korea.
Yes, very limited technical difficulties so far, despite the international nature of this Blogging Heads video. I assume you had a chance to watch the speech over there in South Korea?
Yes, well, I read the speech. I didn't have an opportunity to watch it. I'm sure the oratory would give some added lift to the rhetoric, but I did read it.
I wouldn't be totally certain of that. it was kind of a flat speech, I would say. I would say the people I was watching it with, who neither one of whom is anywhere sort of near where I am on these issues, they both sort of felt like his heart wasn't in it, that this was not necessarily a speech that Obama enjoyed giving.
Interesting. But, well, I'm interested in hearing why that is, or why they thought that, or what you thought about that.
I think Obama is, he doesn't want to be a war president. I mean, he's from an anti-war part of his party. And look, yes, he absolutely made the case for this kind of commitment to Afghanistan throughout the campaign. But, you know, I think this guy's heart is more in it when he's talking about race relations or poverty or health care. At the end of the day, Obama just, I don't believe he's, Bush seemed to genuinely think that this was the most important part of his job. I don't think Obama necessarily feels that way.
Do you think that's sort of why it took so long to arrive at a decision? It took several months after the McChrystal assessment, in the sense that maybe the delay in offering a recommendation or offering his policy to the American public was sort of an implicit recognition that he was reluctant to go with the 30,000 or 40,000 troop request, and that's why he sort of pushed for an exit strategy, that he's sort of reluctant to be the wartime president?
Yeah, I think he's reluctant. I think he's, I would say 4 months, you're starting to see nobody's perfect. And this president, one of his flaws, I would say, seems to be sort of a reluctance to make these kind of decisions, a reluctance to get involved. We actually see it sort of across policy areas. You see it in the stimulus, where he sort of deferred to Congress on how it was written. We see it in healthcare, as he again defers to Congress and doesn't really want to get in there and be the decisive leader on the issue. He always pitched himself as a consensus builder. So I would say that we're starting to see that while it is different than Bush, and certainly Bush was a deeply flawed man, we're starting to see that this may be a little too much in this direction. Maybe that, look, this is not for an administration that came in promising the perfect process. Jim Jones came in and said, look, we're going to have a process nobody's ever seen before. I would say that the American people are not looking at this process in awe. I would say they're sort of confused. What the hell took so long? And at the end of the day, he did pretty much give McChrystal most of what he wanted. So really this, you know, he said last night that, nobody should think he, you know, that the length of this process in any way stalled the arrival of troops in Afghanistan, because there was never an option to send troops before 2010. But you know what? Bullshit. He's the president of the United States. 4 months ago, when the McChrystal request was in, he could have said, you know what? I want to move up the timeline. I want to get additional troops there this year. McKiernan, of course, before he was relieved of command, asked for 10,000 more troops than he got, than McChrystal subsequently got. Look, there were troop requests. I'm just saying, you know, bullshit that the process was like, oh, it didn't matter because nobody was asking for more troops before 2010.
Yeah. I mean, I guess maybe logistically speaking, there would have been some difficulties. But I would agree that, in a sense, that he could deploy as many troops as he want. I mean, of course, there are constraints on the number of forces, especially when you consider that many of the forces are tied down in Iraq right now. And I think that at least the scale back or the scale down work that we're going to see in Iraq, many of those forces are going to be trained and then redeployed into Afghanistan. But he did have a first surge in the first couple months of his administration. It was actually more than the 21,000 that's frequently cited. It was more like 30,000 when you include many of the civilian administrators who were mostly 80%, in fact, were DOD in civilian clothing. But he did have a surge already in this region before. Maybe I think his reluctance to offer his policy to the American public was also because of the division, at least within the country and within his national security apparatus. Whether you're talking about General Petraeus and McChrystal and Clinton on one side, and then you have Biden and Eikenberry and many others who are sort of informing Obama on more of a lighter approach, there's definitely a division within policy circles, within expert circles, even within the military, as far as what we should do, considering the fact that if you want to sort of gain the upper hand against the Taliban insurgency within Afghanistan, you're going to have some sort of legitimate, credible partner. And it's difficult to find any sort of legitimate partner in a country like Afghanistan. And given the tarnished image of Karzai, given the fact that he's considered, at least within Afghanistan, a U.S. puppet, there's all these difficulties. And we actually saw that a little bit within the first 100 days of his administration, Obama's administration, sort of the cold shoulder that the administration gave to the Karzai regime, which is much different than under Bush. Bush had weekly video conferences with Karzai. It was much more of a friendly relationship. Now, going forward, it's going to be very difficult to see how we're going to try and prop up what many Afghans perceive, at least, to be an unpopular, corrupt regime, especially when you consider the number of thugs and warlords and drug traffickers that are within his administration. Going forward, a lot of this will depend on whether Karzai can sort of expunge those corrupt forces within his government. At the same time, Karzai is going to have to navigate a very difficult balance, I think, because many of the warlords that he does have under his power base allow him to sort of have coalition building, especially when you considered Fahim and Dostum and many of the warlords in the northern areas. In a sense, and in some ways, Karzai is going to have to sort of have an arms-length relationship with these warlords. But at the same time, if he pushes them too far, he might be undercutting his own power base and committing political suicide in some respects. So it'll be very difficult to see exactly what's going to happen in the months and years ahead. But I wasn't too shocked with the 30,000 troop recommendation. But I was a little surprised, and even though it was leaked beforehand, I was still a little bit surprised that he asked for an exit strategy, the 18 months within his speech. And in typical, I guess, presidential style, he offered it in a very vague way. He didn't say exactly when those when that 18-month timeline will begin, whether it'll begin at his speech or whether it'll begin when first troops are deployed or when the last units arrive. So he does have a little bit of wiggle room moving forward.
Well,
in this end.
I would say, look, there was a conference call yesterday afternoon with a senior administration official, a background call, but almost everybody in town was on this call. It took an hour to get. I mean, it was like a joke, but this call, they really got pushed on some of this stuff, and it was really, I think everybody who listened to this was sort of struck by just how much wiggle room they're giving themselves. It's almost Bush-like. This is not a hard deadline. They kept saying over and over again that any drawdown would be dictated by conditions on the ground, which, of course, was the mantra of the McCain campaign and of the Bush administration. And look, they talked about a surge. They talked about conditions on the ground. Somebody asked if, what would the administration say? It was some lunatic foreign press guy, but he says, what would the administration say to the Iranians who see this as a continuation of the Bush administration policy in Afghanistan? And the administration official said, well, I can understand how it would look that way because there is continuity and because our interests are the same. And it was like, did he really just say that? Did an Obama administration official really just say there's continuity and we have the same interests and we're doing the same kind of thing? So it was an interesting moment where before the speech, I would say that his officials were going even further than Obama himself in sort of trying to give them maximum flexibility on these things. Look, at the end of the day, it's going to be very difficult. And I think this is why a lot of Republicans are going to support this. And indeed, you know, Mitch McConnell was on the phone afterwards saying he supports this. Sarah Palin said she supports it. My boss, Bill Kristol, was out there calling Obama a war president and supporting it. I think you're going to see a lot of conservatives support this because at the end of the day, what's he going to do? He just sent 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan. He's going to have 100,000 American troops there. And he says this is a necessary war and we have to do it for world security and blah, blah, blah. And then he has some sort of weird, vague 18-month timeline. But he's going to fight for 18 months. At the end of that, does anyone really think that he's going to draw a line in the sand and say, you know what, we didn't achieve any of our goals, but we're going to pull all these troops out and just forget about everything I said 18 months ago, everything I said in the campaign. You know, you can't walk away from this. So I think the people on my side are sort of looking at that as total, totally not serious drop dead date. So I don't think it's a real.
I mean, you do bring up an interesting point. I think that the administration, and this is sort of true of any administration in wartime, is that they sort of have to define the terms of the war, the terms of the engagement, the terms of success and victory. I think what we've seen over the past 8 years, including under President Obama, is a lack of clearly defined and achievable objectives. This is sort of the overarching grouse that many within my camp, at least, had with the counterinsurgency, the population-centric counterinsurgency approach, is that there was no real defined end game to this. It could be going on in perpetuity if the end goal was to sort of have a non-corrupt, stable electoral democracy in Afghanistan. We could be there foreseeably for the next 20, 30 years and still see a country that looks dysfunctional, dirt poor, and isolated. So I think that at least for the Obama administration, within the next 18 months, or for that matter, 24 months, or however long they begin this process of scaling down, if the scale down even does happen, how they define success will be critical, whether it's defined as sealing the borders, or whether it's defined as decreased troop casualties versus civilian casualties, whether it's the number of say, corrupt officials within the Karzai government, or whether it's the number of troops within the Afghan National Security Forces. Whatever benchmarks they set will be set within Washington and not necessarily in Kabul. And so I do think that's an interesting point. But then also I think there's sort of a disconnect as well between the political side and the military side. Politically speaking, Barack Obama cannot allow the Taliban to win, whatever that means. You know, you can't really allow the Taliban to gain a foothold in many areas of this country, at least in the southern and eastern portions where the insurgency is strongest. But militarily, it looks very unlikely that we'll be able to expunge the Taliban simply because they are an indigenous guerrilla force, and especially when you consider the cross-border sanctuaries and within the Pashtun tribal belt straddling both countries. It'll be very difficult militarily, at least. And military folks will tell you that. I mean, this is very much a faceless enemy. They can melt into the population. They live amongst the people. And in fact, the Taliban have come out sort of with their own counterinsurgency strategy of trying to limit civilian casualties, of allowing themselves to be sort of a force of swift justice. This is sort of what counterinsurgency expert David Kilcullen has mentioned before, that when you're losing in an insurgency, you're not being outfought, you're being outgoverned. And these conditions that we see now at the tail end of 2009 is the exact same conditions that we saw the Taliban's rise in the 1990s. Amid a lot of chaos, a lot of anarchy, the Taliban sort of arose, bizarrely enough, even though they are draconian, they are brutal, but they arose as sort of a Robin Hood sort of character. They offered swift justice again to people. Again, 10 to 12% of Afghanistan's land is arable. Only 10 to 12% of it is arable. And so a lot of disputes arise through property rights and sort of demarcations of property and homes and of cultivable land. And so the Taliban said that we'll offer, you know, sort of a rudimentary judicial system. We'll offer safety and protection, basic services. And that's sort of how they arose, especially in these Pashtun-dominant areas. And so whether we can do that, whether we can provide that justice, whether we can provide that sort of basic services and security will be very difficult. Whether you're talking about...
Well, this is the key to a population securing strategy, right? This is why counterinsurgency strategy is so important. Is to be on the ground in these villages, providing some sort of government service, security. I mean, this is the point of their strategy. Is exactly what you're saying.
Right,
yet,
right.
And yet you were not in favor. You were totally against the strategy. So you wanted the over-the-horizon Joe Biden standoff and drop bomb strategy.
Well, right. I think that the thing is for population-centric counterinsurgency approach, and we sort of discussed this in the previous session, is that you need a high density of troops per population. So you need for in the U.S. Marine Corps and Army counterinsurgency field manual, they recommend at least 20 to 25 counterinsurgents per 1,000 indigenous people. So you need 200,000 troops in the South alone, and the South is where the insurgency is strongest. We don't have that. Most of our forces are sort of concentrated now in regional command South, and especially in Helmand province, but we are also seeing Taliban gains in regional command North, and whether or not we can deploy forces there, whether or not we are spread too thin, that's really a complex sort of situation. But I think also we have to consider whether or not we are a legitimate presence and whether we're a legitimate force, and regardless of how many troops we deploy, whether we can actually win people to our side. And I think this was sort of alluded to several weeks ago by Secretary of Defense Robert Gates when he said, how do you communicate resolve while at the same time not appearing to have an open-ended commitment? What's unfortunate with his statement is that they're completely incompatible objectives. You can't communicate resolve while at the same time saying that you're not going to have an open-ended commitment. And this is sort of the problem with any number of troops. And, of course, the present strategy requires more troops than we can ever send.
This was a big problem with Obama's speech last night. This was, I think, a real problem. And, look, Bush, you always knew that he really was. I mean, it was his ass on the line, but he was really committed to winning, you know, for whatever. You could say it's because he's, you know, he's obsessed with his legacy, whatever it was, but he always knew that, like, Bush was in it for the long haul. And with Obama, you sort of get the feeling that he doesn't want to be doing this. He's sending these mixed messages with the date for withdrawal and while simultaneously, and, like, who's he bullshitting here? I mean, he's going to send 30,000 additional troops and tell me this is part of his exit strategy. You know, it's sort of Orwellian. His heart's not in it. He clearly, you know, in the 2011 date, it's like nobody's stupid here. We get it. You want to start pulling troops out before you run for re-election. So I sort of feel like, you know, that is a problem. How does this guy? Look, Bush, I think he did a pretty good job of communicating that he was going to be there. This guy, it's not. He would like any first chance he has to start pulling troops out. You get the sense that's what he would do, even if that meant, you know, 5 years from now the Taliban are sitting back in Kandahar in charge.
Well, I think this is sort of the problem, is that there's a can versus should. Can we change the situation on the ground with regardless of any number of troops? And if we pour in more troops, whether it's 30,000 or 50,000 or 100,000, will we be sort of allowing the Taliban to position themselves as a force against what they perceive to be a foreign occupation of their region? There is sort of a understanding the enemy, sort of, so to speak.